On February 28, 2024, national polygamy advocate Mark Henkel shares SCOTUS decision, Reynolds v. United States of 1878, Part 4. Hello, friends, supporters, listeners, and sharers. When does a Supreme Court want to have its cake and eat it too? As we shall see here, apparently, it is when the whimsy of the Supreme Court contradicts its reasons for allowing jurors with hypothetical opinions that might favor the government prosecution, while also disallowing other jury candidates with hypothetical opinions that might not favor the government prosecution. Let's go even deeper, shall we? In the previous episode of this podcast, episode number 310 of February 21, 2024, which was part 3 of this multi-part mini-series about the U.S. Supreme Court decision, Reynolds v. United States of 1878, I addressed the second question, question number 2, of the 6 questions that the Supreme Court of the United States, SCOTUS for short, had addressed in this important decision against polygamy. In this episode here, episode number 311 of February 28, 2024, this part 4 episode will address the third question of those 6 questions. As question number 2, as per the past at part 3 episode, pertained to challenges to jury selection, question 3, in this part 4 episode, also pertains to challenges to jury selection. From the specific text of the decision of Reynolds v. United States, we see that Chief Justice Waite wrote, quote, "Three, were the challenges of certain other jurors by the government improperly sustained?" Unquote. As the attorneys for defendant George Reynolds had challenged jurors for having admitted that they had formed opinions, the lower court overruled those challenges, letting the government proceed with jurors that could be seen as favoring the prosecution. In this next question, question 3, the prosecution had challenged other jurors for potentially, we could even say only hypothetically, not favoring the prosecution. From the text of the decision, quote, "The court also, when Homer Brown was called as a juror, allowed the district attorney to ask him the following questions. Question: Are you living in polygamy? Answer: I would rather not answer that. The court instructed the witness that he must answer the question unless it could criminate him. By the district attorney: You understand the conditions upon which you refuse? Answer: Yes, sir. Question: Have you such an opinion that you could not find a verdict for the commission of that crime? Answer: I have no opinion on it in this particular case. I think, under the evidence and the law, I could render a verdict accordingly. Whereupon, the United States challenged the said Brown for favor, which challenge was sustained by the court, and the defendant accepted. John W. Snell, also a juror, was asked by the district attorney on voir dire. Question: Are you living in polygamy? Answer: I decline to answer that question. Question: On what ground? Answer: It might criminate myself, but I am only a fornicator. Whereupon, Snell was challenged by the United States for cause, which challenge was sustained, and the defendant accepted. Unquote. What we see from this is that these two jurors, Homer Brown and John W. Snell, were both asked by the prosecution the same question, i.e., are you living in polygamy? Both Brown and Snell refused to answer that question on the grounds that doing so might incriminate them, what we now call pleading the Fifth, as in the Fifth Amendment. the prosecution assumed that those two jurors were likely to be polygamists, likely to also be breaking the very same law for which defendant George Reynolds was being tried in court. The prosecution assumed the hypothetical likelihood that the jury candidates would have and still have formed opinions in the case which would not be favorable to the prosecution. Hence, the prosecution challenged the qualifications of Brown and Snell to be selected for the jury. The court sustained those challenges, which means Brown and Snell were disallowed by that lower court to be selected as jurors. As I now again cite the text of the decision, Chief Justice Waite wrote, quote, 3. As to the challenges by the government, the questions raised upon these assignments of error are not whether the district attorney should have been permitted to interrogate the jurors while under examination upon their voir dire, as to the fact of their living in polygamy. No objection was made below to the questions, but only to the ruling of the court upon the challenges after the testimony taken in answer to the questions was in. From the testimony, it is apparent that all the jurors to whom the challenges related were or had been living in polygamy. It needs no argument to show that such a jury could not have gone into the box entirely free from bias and prejudice, and that if the challenge was not good for principal cause, it was for favor. A judgment will not be reversed simply because a challenge good for favor was sustained in form for cause. As the jurors were incompetent and properly excluded, it matters not here upon what form of challenge they were set aside. In one case, the challenge was for favor. In the courts of the United States, all challenges are tried by the court without the aid of triers, and we are not advised that the practice in the territorial courts of Utah is different. Unquote. What we see from this is a double standard by the court. For clarity, let's first understand the difference between a challenge for cause versus a challenge for favor. Brown was challenged for favor. Snell was challenged for cause. A challenge for cause is when the challenger believes the juror could not be fair or unbiased. A challenge for favor is when the challenger has no principal challenge, but only has a suspicion about the prospective juror. The word hypothetical comes back to mind, as we remember how the same Supreme Court would not set aside jurors in question number 2 for merely the hypothetical possibility of partiality, of bias. Hence, in this question number 3, SCOTUS was still allowing mere suspicion by favor, even if a challenge was not made for outright cause. In the previous question number 2, the Supreme Court said that a juror who had formed an opinion would not be set aside, even when the juror openly admitted that they still held that formed opinion. Yet, in this question number 3, that 1878 SCOTUS said that a juror who might or might not have formed an opinion would still be set aside, merely because the disallowed jury candidate proverbially pled the Fifth Amendment on a question of whether they were living in polygamy. Pleading the Fifth is not legally considerable as evidence or proof of guilt. Nevertheless, the prosecution was merely perceiving, guessing, if you will, a hypothetical bias from Brown and Snell, and the court permitted that hypothetical basis. This is so important to understand that I will reiterate it again. Even though the court had played a nuancing word game in answering the previous question number 2 to allow jurors who supposedly only had a hypothetical bias. Here, with question number 3, however, the court was in direct contradiction of that view by herewith disallowing would-be jurors who also only had a hypothetical bias, only as guessed by the prosecution, because the men had pled the Fifth Amendment to not say whether they were or were not living in polygamy. What we see between question number 2 and question number 3 is that the 1878 Supreme Court sought to proverbially have its cake and eat it too. As I explained in the previous episode of this podcast, so much for impartial jurors. The court allowed jurors whom the prosecution saw as favorable in question number 2, and yet simultaneously disallowed other possible jurors whom the prosecution saw as hypothetically unfavorable here in question number 3. In question number 2, a juror specifically said that their formed opinion would not affect their ability to judge fairly. In question number 3, another juror equally specifically said the very same thing, that even though they pled the Fifth about living or not living in polygamy, it would not affect their ability to judge fairly. If the court could believe the former, it absolutely should have likewise believed the latter. Indeed, in the latter, in this question number 3, it was overtly stating that Brown and Snell were, quote, incompetent and properly excluded, unquote, by which the 1878 Supreme Court revealed its overt bias. So there we have it, even more clearly, the bias revealed by the hypocrisy. No doubt, to obfuscate and hide its bias, playing word games of nuance, the 1878 Supreme Court of the United States wanted to proverbially have its cake and eat it too. As we dive even more deeply into this case and decision, we shall observe even more of this same bias and prejudice from that 1878 Supreme Court as we look into the other remaining 3 questions of the 6 questions that SCOTUS determined in this case. Toward that end, yes, I will share the 1878 Supreme Court's answer to the next question, the 4th question, question number 4, in a coming podcast episode, identified as SCOTUS Decision, Reynolds v. United States of 1878, Part 5. So still with more to come, stay tuned! And as always, thank you for celebrating, supporting, listening to, and sharing the National Polygamy Advocate podcast.
Mark Henkel is National Polygamy Advocate, presenting polygamy to the public since 1994. NationalPolygamyAdvocate.com